From KUWR News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last June, in the wake of the mass shooting at a gay club in Orlando, Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox spoke at a vigil in Salt Lake City. And the remarks kind of went viral. They certainly got a lot of attention around here. Cox told the crowd that he apologized for having an intolerant attitude in the past, and he said that his heart had changed. The reason this was seen as extraordinary is Cox is part of a conservative administration, and he's a Latter-day Saint, so his remarks came off as maybe unconventional for his position. But there are a number of times in his life when he's gone this way, that is, away from the expected, and we wanted to talk to him about it. So Spencer Cox is joining us today to talk about the decisions he's made in his life. After the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox seemed to be a little thrown off last June when a speech he gave at a vigil for the victims of the mass shooting in Orlando went viral. People all over the country were talking about it and sharing it, and it was a lovely speech where he talked about the importance of dignity and kindness. But as he told MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell, who interviewed him about it on the network, I think it's pretty sad that a speech by a lieutenant governor in Utah is getting this much attention just by saying we should love each other. And then he asked, how low is the bar in our country? But he must have known why the speech seemed important. Cox is part of a conservative administration. He's a conservative Republican himself, or maybe a moderate. Anyway, he's also a very active Latter-day Saint, used to be a bishop. And so when he said to the crowd at that vigil that his heart had changed over the years, no one was entirely sure just what he meant by it, but the gesture seemed important. And that's just one of the things we wanted to talk to him about. So today in the program, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox is with us. He was appointed Utah's Lieutenant Governor in October of 2013. He has a law degree from Washington and Lee School of Law in Virginia. He was vice president and general counsel of Centricom. It's a telecommunications company that's been run by his family in San Pete County for many years now. He also served as a councilman, a city councilman, mayor of Fairview City, commissioner for San Pete County. Joining us here in the studio, and Mr. Lieutenant Governor, thank you very much for taking the time. Welcome.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be with you.
I guess I wanted to begin where everyone does when they talk to you is then that is your life on the farm, growing up on on the family farm, which you've said you hated, but as you reflect back on it now, you've kind of come to appreciate it. What was it? Just the essentials, right? Good hard work.
Sure.
Those are the basics.
Yeah, all of the above. You know, like any kid that would rather be doing things other than working. I don't think I was special in that sense. It was a dairy farm that my dad grew up on. My great 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 grandfather settled there over 160 years ago.
Yeah. So you're really connected.
Really connected to that place and to that land. And so I'd have to get up early before school to go out and move sprinkler pipe, change water, and, plow the fields and haul the hay and the things that farm kids do. And couldn't wait to get out of there. Swore I'd never come back. Yeah. My wife grew up on a ranch in Mount Pleasant. We went to high school together. Same thing. She couldn't wait to get out of there. And after a while, we realized that who we were was influenced in large part by where we came from. Yeah. And we got a chance to go back and raise our kids there. And now my kids are cursing my name the way I cursed my dad's name and his dad before him. And that's a good thing.
When you thought, I want to get out of here, when your wife, Abby, thought, I want to get out of here, what did that mean? Did you know what that meant? Like go to Salt Lake or go to New York or go to Washington? What was the idea?
So I knew from a fairly early age that law school was something that I wanted to do. And so I was going to go to BYU. She said, I'm going to Utah State, have fun at BYU. And I'm an Aggie now, a smart guy. I followed my wife there.
Right.
Best decision I ever made, both her and Utah State. And so we just started applying to law schools and decided we would go on an adventure and see where it took us. She'd promised me I could go to BYU for law school and had a chance to do that. But we had other opportunities, decided to go to Virginia and loved our 3 years at Washington and Lee. And thought about staying on the East Coast. We really did. Hmm. I was fortunate to have options. And her dad started to have some health problems and she decided she wanted to be a little closer there. So we took a job at a big law firm here in Salt Lake and lived in Davis County and thought we had arrived.
Yeah. And you were in the suburbs and life was good?
Yeah. Yeah. Life was perfect. We had two little boys that were born in Virginia and a third one on the way and thought this is where we were going to end up and live our lives. And then we had that third boy and just things started to change and we knew we needed to get back and raise those boys somewhere else.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. I want to talk about that. But there's this thing that you've said in an interview that I wanted to ask you about. Your parents were divorced when you were 10 years old. And you've talked about that being a really difficult time for you. You went through it, but one of the things you said was you went through some bullying.
Yeah.
And you had some, you even said there were times when you had these suicidal thoughts. Now, I'm not sure how much you want to talk about that, but what can you say about that time?
Well, I think it's something, whether we want to talk about it, I think it's something we need to talk about. I think it's a problem in our country. It's a problem in our state. You look at the numbers, unfortunately, far too many kids are taking their lives. It was difficult, again, being in a small, rural, conservative town. Not a lot of divorce then. And I remember...
Overwhelmingly Mormon, of course.
Of course, yeah. Typical Utah town. I remember going to events at growing up and where they would read off the names of the parents, right? And the bad kids, inevitably, they would have two sets of parents, you know, or their parents were divorced, they'd have different names. And So my first thought is, oh, now I'm one of them, right? Now I'm one of these kids.
Yeah.
And
you were ashamed of that?
A little bit.
Yeah.
It was tough. And then I was kind of a nerd in school and the bullying, you know, getting picked on. I remember in middle school, it was pretty intense at times. And that was just tough. It's tough on any kid. And so, I made my way through. I dealt with it. Fortunately, I was very lucky. I have great people that care about me and loved me, my parents included. My dad remarried. I was living with my dad. He married my stepmom, who has been a savior to me. She loved me like I was her own. She cared for me. I didn't treat her very well for the first few years, but
That idea when you're like having a tough time with that transition. You're not my mom. How can you tell me what to do? All that business?
Yeah, all of that stuff. Yeah. And she had children from a previous marriage, and so now we're mixed. So I have new brothers and sisters.
That was rough.
I'm the oldest. That was rough. Yeah. Trying to deal with these changes in life, and what does that mean? And So, over time we figured it out, and I was, in retrospect, I was grateful for that period in my life. It's helped influence a lot of what I do and who I am. I think empathy.
In what way? That empathy.
I think empathy is a big thing and something that's missing from the public square. I think it's something that's increasingly missing from the lives of individuals, and I think is partially responsible for the many of the problems we're seeing in our society and the divisions that we see, the addictions that we see in people's lives as they're trying to find ways, coping mechanisms for the problems that they have, and where I think empathy and love are things that I had to learn the hard way, but that I learned from a stepmom, that I learned from other family members and friends who cared about me in spite of who I was or the way I was lashing out or acting at the time.
Do you think you could trace in some way a line from that speech you gave last June where you talked about your heart being changed to that experience as a 10-year-old kid trying to get through the shame in a small conservative town? You know what I mean? I mean, did that experience, like now you were sort of an outsider, or at least you were different and you hadn't been before. Did that give you some insight into what the way you've been thinking about that?
Unquestionably, yeah, it did. I think back to those times and again to the people that were kind to me in a difficult situation that didn't need to be, especially people I wasn't kind to. And it impacts everything I do. I still make mistakes, but my parents taught me to try to put yourself in the shoes of someone else and what that means. And you don't know what they're going through or what that feels like. And as I've talked to members of the LGBT community and others and listen to their stories, there are some similarities there. And it's helped me care more.
I want to ask you about, I don't know how much time we need to spend with the fact that you play bass in a rock band called Upside. Was music, I mean, you said you would fairly early on, it sounds like you had set your mind on, I'm going to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
But was there ever a point when you thought, I could be a bass player?
Well, not a bass player, but I wanted to be a rock star. Yeah. I mean, doesn't every kid?
Yes.
I mean, once I realized I couldn't play in the NBA, I mean, that was first.
Right.
Then rock star was second. Attorney was a distant third. So music was kind of my escape growing up. My parents made me take piano lessons from a very early age, and so that was important. I sang in choirs. I was in the band, hence, some of the bullying that went on.
Yeah.
The marching band wasn't the coolest thing. In rural Utah at the time, but yeah, music. I could escape in my room, turn it up as loud as I wanted, and so that played a role. I always wanted to be in a band, finally I got that midlife crisis where my brother and I said, well, why not? Let's just do this, and it's been a lot of fun. It's still a good escape for me to get out of the political world and everything else, and just let my hair down. Not that I have any left, but. It works.
Right. But I get the point. But were you a rebellious kid? Like rebellious in, like there's rebellious in Mormon small town, like he went out back and chewed tobacco or something. And then
right.
There's really rebellious. Like where were you in that?
No, I was not rebellious at all. And I think if you talk to people that knew me growing up, that's just not who I am or who I was.
Because you were pretty Mormon.
Very much so. Yeah, very dedicated to my religion. I was an Eagle Scout at age 13.
Yeah.
I did all of those things. In fact, it was those, I've talked about my parents, but there was one leader in my church in particular who really saved me. Mm-hmm. And he was a convert to the LDS church, and I wasn't his project, at least I never felt like his project, but he cared about me and he was always there for me and he loved me and just happened to be in certain positions at certain times in my life when I needed somebody like that. Mm-hmm. and really helped me. So yeah, I was never that rebellious kid on the outside, just a lot of turmoil on the inside.
You went on an LDS mission to Mexico.
Yeah.
Did you ever, in that sort of formative part of your life, yes, you were a devoted Latter-day Saint, but did you ever have, not a faith crisis, but were there ever moments when you had doubt and you wondered, you had to come to those big questions about, all right, is this something I'm going to devote my life to?
Yeah, I think everybody goes through those moments, regardless of what your faith is or is not. For me, there were stepping stones along the way that really challenged me, I think. But the one in particular that stands out the most, it was actually after I was on my mission. I was actually in the MTC. I was in Provo, and I'm sitting there. I've got my girlfriend back home. I'm missing my family. I'm leaving for 2 years. I'm going to this strange country where I don't know anything or the people or the culture. And I remember just laying there thinking, this is nuts. Like, who does this? Why, 2 years, the best years of my life, and I'm leaving this? I'm like, I can't do this unless I really know, unless I really believe that this is it, that this is true. It was a really long night for me, a lot of soul searching, a lot of prayer. But I had an experience, just an incredible experience where by that morning, I knew that this was what I was supposed to do and that this was true. And had an incredible 2 years and no regrets. It was amazing.
In one profile of you I read, it said that politics runs in the family blood. Your father was mayor. Your father was county commissioner. Your father was city councilman like you. You've sort of been all of those.
All of those, all three, yeah.
But it's also interesting that you seem to be a little disillusioned with the idea of politicians. So how do you square that? The idea of being, you studied political science in college. You, let's be honest, you are a politician now, whether you sort of like the term or not.
No.
So it seems like you have a conflicted relationship with it. Yet on one hand, it's embedded in who you are in some ways.
Yeah, very conflicted. That's the best term for it. And I don't think that – I don't see that as a problem. I think there are a lot of dichotomies in our life where we try to balance things. And so I love the idea of our country. I love the idea of our republic. I love the idea of representative democracy. I love the idea of picking flawed people to do really important things for us. And that's what I espouse and I believe in. And although it's in my blood, my dad was the very same way. I mean, he was always very reluctant. Hmm. It was not something he sought after or felt like he was defined by. It was just kind of part of it was like farming. It's just something you did. And in rural Utah, almost everybody gets a turn at it because there's so few of us. You know, we have to beg people to run for city council in our town. So it's a little different than maybe you would see in Salt Lake City or some of our bigger, more populated areas. And so that was important, but it was never something that was shoved down our throat. We didn't sit around the breakfast table talking about the presidential election. It's just not what we did. But
your dad said you read the paper all the time, though.
I did, and that was me. I was fascinated by world events. And so I would wake up early and read the paper
How old were you starting to read the paper?
That started when I was 10, 11 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I mean, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's strange, I think, is what you mean. I think extraordinary is the word for it. It's weird.
But what were you looking at? I mean, it wasn't events. I mean, did you just like the interplay of politics or the – I mean, what was it about?
I like – knowledge. I like stuff. I was, and it was always sports first. Let's be clear.
Okay,
so it was
okay.
A sports section first, and then everything else. But I just wanted to know. I had kind of this insatiable quest to know what was happening in the world around me, and it wasn't just politics. It was everything that was going on. So I'd get up and I'd watch the morning news show and read the paper, and then I would go to school, and that's what I did. But going back to that dichotomy, that idea that you can serve but not seek after service. I think that's one of the things I loved about the founding of our country. We had many reluctant servants there. George Washington is my favorite example of that. The guy just wanted to go back to Mount Vernon and farm, and he finally got the opportunity to do that. And thank goodness. I mean, he could have served for forever, but he didn't. And I think that example was the one we were supposed to learn from, that these aren't supposed to be lifetime jobs or lifetime callings, that we're supposed to go in, work really hard, give of ourselves, get back to our communities, and then go back and do something else. And I look forward to that day. You know, I'm in this weird situation. I didn't run to be lieutenant governor, and that just came out of nowhere.
It did.
And so I have the luxury of being able to truthfully say that I didn't seek this, and I can't wait to be done. But I also am the luckiest guy on earth. I won the lottery, right? I mean, I didn't have to run for this, and I get these amazing experiences, and I get to try to make a difference, and we're very lucky to do that.
You know, so studying political science at college, was that just the thing you did to get into law school?
Or absolutely. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, that's it.
Yeah.
That was it. I mean, I looked at it. I know I'm going to law school. Everybody that goes to law school, most people go political science. Hey, I like politics. Sure. That works for me.
See, because I wondered if it was that, or if part of it was also you liked the philosophy of it, the history of it. I'm sure that was appealing on some level, but it was just you didn't feel passionate about political science.
No, I was not passionate about political science. I love history, and so I was passionate about the history piece, and I love to write, and so it was just the perfect way for me to prepare for something else. But I wasn't the guy saying I'm going into political science because someday I'm going to be the lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
Of course, nobody aspires to be the lieutenant governor, but imagine aspiring to something else, governor, whatever, senator. No, that was not in my DNA at the time.
You killed it at USU. 4.0 grade point average. Got accepted to Harvard Law.
Yeah.
It seems to me like you were pretty driven. Is that fair? Or have you always been this way?
No, I don't know that I've always been that way. I loved Utah State. I mean, it was just a great experience. I'd been at Snow College before that.
A lot of people love a school, but getting 4.0. I mean, like straight, you were pretty serious about
school. Well, I was back from my mission. I'm married now. Yeah. You know,
on a path now. I got to...
Yeah, life gets real when that happens. And I just had great professors, and I found out that I loved it. It was fascinating to me. Again, the history piece, the world events piece, just things that were happening at that time. You know, I get back from my mission, it's 1996, and so we're right in the middle of a presidential election. It's Bill Clinton, Bob Dole at the time, and my father-in-law wants to talk to me about presidential elections, and you know, I'm going to school now and I'm learning about this stuff, and I caught a little bit of the bug at that time.
Yeah,
it was good stuff.
But by that, do you mean you were pretty outspoken? Did you ever see yourself that way? Like, when did you really dig into these conversations with your father-in-law, for example?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And I don't know that outspoken, that's never really kind of been who I am. Yeah. But the depth of the conversations increased. And I loved having the debates. I loved that piece of college, sitting around a table with really smart people who were making me smarter, and professors who cared and who challenged. And so things I thought I knew, you know, they would push back. And I would have to research and be able to debate and be able to hold my own, and I found that I could do it and gain the respect of my colleagues and my professors.
So you got into Harvard Law, but you didn't go to Harvard Law. You decided to go to Washington and Lee instead. And one thing I read you had said, I just knew I was supposed to be there. What is that? I mean, I'm guessing. Maybe this is religious, but it seems like there's the kind of an intuition, a sense of purpose that helps drive the decisions you make.
Sure, and there is a religious component to it. You know, I don't try to avoid that at all. I believe the author Brené Brown has this great. You know, she talks about this concept, how important it is to believe that the universe is conspiring for you, in favor of you, and I feel like. Each of us has a purpose. Each of us has a path, things we're supposed to do. And if we try to follow that, whether you believe it's religion or intuition or whatever that is, I think it's important to success and to confidence. And so we had just, you know, everybody told me, you don't say no to Harvard, right? You just don't. You got into Harvard. You just go. And we had prayed about it. We had trying to decide what we were supposed to do. This Washington and Lee thing actually came up later. I thought I was choosing between BYU and Harvard at the time. And part of it was financial. It's really expensive to go to Harvard. Yeah. And part of it was lifestyle, you know, what's best for our family. But I had a very clear feeling, intuition, answer to a prayer as I was reading the Bible, actually, and just felt like I wasn't supposed to do that. It wasn't right for me for whatever reason. It may be right for others. And then Washington and Lee came up, and we happened to go back there, and we immediately fell in love with the place and knew that's where we were supposed to go. I mean, this campus, you're in the Shenandoah Mountains. Yeah. It's named after George Washington because he gave an endowment to the college at the time. I mean, like, you know, the George Washington. This wasn't something they named later after he was gone. And so we knew that's where we were supposed to go, and it was the right thing for us, and I'm glad we did.
It's interesting. So you graduate from law school, you come back to Utah, work for a very successful firm. You seem to be on another track. And then there's this is a great story. You're driving along with your wife.
Yeah.
Who seems great. I want to get back to Abby, by the way, because she seems terrific.
You should really interview her.
Really?
It would be a much better,
get her.
Much better interview.
And she sees this. I'm not sure if it was she who sees the bumper sticker and points it out to you or whatever, but would you tell this story? Because I think this is really interesting.
Yeah, so it's actually me, and I see this bumper sticker, and it says it's 99% of attorneys that give the other 1% a bad name, you know, and she's laughing, and that's funny, and I'm like, yeah, wait a minute.
You've heard your share of lawyer jokes.
I've heard my share of lawyer jokes, but it led to this discussion. We're talking about just life and where we are. We have, again, these two boys. We've just had our third boy, or close, you know, he's about to be born, and And I asked this very simple question, and I just said, is the world a better place because of what I'm doing? You know, and in her very blunt farm girl persona, she turns to me and says, absolutely not. You know, and it wasn't for a lack of trying. And I'm not casting aspersions at all attorneys in any sense. There are a lot of attorneys out there doing really good things, but I was working really hard. Yep. And I was having success, and I loved the law firm and the people I worked with, but it just felt like something was kind of missing from our lives at the time. And so we started to reevaluate, you know, what was important to us and the things that mattered, and that was family and faith and then giving back to community. And I looked at the example of my parents and realized I didn't have time to do any of that. You know, it was the minute I woke up to the minute I went to bed, it was a grind. And so about that time, I get a call from my dad, and he says, hey, how would you like to come back and work with the family company, take a huge cut in pay, and raise your kids back here? We'd love to have you. And it just felt right to both of us. So we made that leap of faith, and the rest is kind of history.
Yeah. Did you miss the land? Like the landscape of the place?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The mountains, the quiet, the slower pace of life, the people, all of it. Yeah, I did. I did. There are some things I didn't miss, too. You know, yeah. It's the...
Like what?
Everybody knows your business,
yep.
You know, and that's great sometimes, yep. And not so great other times. But it was interesting.
I mean, there couldn't be more of a contrast, I think some people would say. And I hope this isn't patronizing to people who live in rural parts of the country, but, you know, you're thinking of living on the East Coast. Like, maybe we raise our kids on the East Coast. Maybe that's our place. And you end up not just in Utah, but in rural Utah. I mean, the contrast there is pretty interesting. And I guess you're right. You went through the give and take. It's a small town that it's a monoculture. That had to have been part of it that made you think, even though you are a Latter-day Saint, I'm sure that you saw diversity in your experience in college and your experience, you know, just, you know, working. So you had to, I guess you had to work through all of that, yeah?
Right, right. Absolutely, we did. And it wasn't an easy decision. I mean, the conversation you and I are having right now are the same conversations my wife and I had. This is what we're giving up. You look at, you know, quality of education in schools and the diversity and the educational opportunities outside of school, the cultural opportunities, some of those things that we don't have there. Again, I'm very fortunate. Sampy County. We're only 45 minutes from Utah County, and I'm commuting to Salt Lake, so an hour and 40 minutes to Salt Lake, and so we haven't given up all of those opportunities, but it's also a chance to give something back to a place that made me who I am and gave me everything that I am, and I've loved that, and that's where the public service thing started, was someone coming and asking me, hey, you know, there's a vacancy on the city council. We need to appoint someone. We would really like you. Are you interested?
And we needed the free legal services.
Yeah, I'm flattered, but you know, this is it.
Yeah.
They needed legal help. And so, yeah, I say, okay, now I have this set of skills that I've learned. Here's a chance for me to help my town, my little town that made me who I am. And I'm so proud of that more than anything else. You know, people ask, is it hard to be the lieutenant governor? And it is, but I'll tell you what's harder. That's being on the city council in a small town.
Right?
I mean, because every problem is your problem and your neighbor and someone you know and care about deeply. And you don't escape that. You've got an issue. You know this person and they know you and they know where to find you.
Spencer Cox is with us. He is, of course, Utah's lieutenant governor, the 8th lieutenant governor, it turns out. We need to take a break. We're late for the break. So we'll do that and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're having a conversation with the state's Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. He has been getting some attention for some, at least some see it, unconventional attitudes about politics and social issues. He gave a memorable speech in June about LGBT issues that surprised some people. He's joining us to talk about that and other things. Let's talk about that June speech, this vigil for the victims of the mass shooting at Orlando. How long did it take you to write that? And how are you thinking about that? Did it represent sort of the culmination of some thinking, or is it just an expression of where you had ended up, or what was it?
So I get a call on a Sunday. I get a message asking if I'd be willing to speak at this vigil. And I reached out to the governor and our staff and said, hey, I've been invited to do this. Any concerns? They said, no, you're fine. Go ahead. And so I said yes and started thinking about what I might say. Unfortunately, the next day was crazy. I had a really busy day. I had to move some things around on my schedule. I had about 2 hours prior to the vigil. That was the only time I had to sit down and actually put pen to paper. And
so you hadn't
something.
Written until 2 hours
written.
Before.
I thought about it.
Sure.
You know, I was thinking about it that night. What could I say? Actually, after I said yes, I thought, what have I done? This was a terrible mistake. I don't know what to say. You know, they don't want to hear from me. And I immediately start second guessing it. But I thought, well, I can't get out of it now. I'm there. So I went. I had to get off the hill. I had to get away from people. Mm-hmm. I went, sat down, just said a little prayer and just started writing. And I ended up having about an hour and I wrote it from beginning to end. I read through it once, made a couple corrections, sent it to our comms guy, said, I'm on my way, jumped in my car, said, if you have any issues, let me know. And as I'm walking up on the stage, he texts back and says, it looks good. Just go for it. Good luck. And that was it. So the first time I had actually read it out loud or verbalized it at all. Now, saying all of that, it was clearly a culmination of thinking that had been happening internally to me over years.
Yeah.
This wasn't something that just came out. This was just an opportunity to express something that I'd been feeling for quite a while to a group of people who would appreciate it maybe more than most at a very sensitive time. But that was it. I mean, that was the end of any expectations that I had with that speech. It was as I finished, you know, I had a chance to stick around for a while, and there were five or six other amazing speeches that night, and just incredibly heartbreaking, touching, inspiring, and I had a chance to sit around and just talk to people who were there, who came up and wanted to talk for about an hour afterwards. Mm-hmm. Then I had to jump in the car and drive 200 miles down to it so I could get up early to another meeting, and that was it, you know. And so
you had no idea that it was going to be a thing, because
it
was
clue.
A thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a lot of people paid attention to it. And why do you figure that is?
I don't know. I've tried to figure that out. I mean, I
you get
intuitively,
it. Mormon
I
guy
get
from a Republican
sure,
administration.
Sure. It makes a good headline, right?
Yep.
So the next day, it gets covered with all the other speeches, you know, and I hear a little bit back from people. Hey, we appreciate you. Thank you for your kindness for reaching out. And then, So 24 hours later, I get a message from someone at KSL that said, we really like your speech. Would you mind if we just post it on our website? We just print it. And I think the Salt Lake Tribune had some video of it, but they yeah. had the written piece. And I said, that's fine. That's nice. Wake up the next morning, you know, everything's good. I go to a meeting and all of a sudden my phone just starts kind of blowing up and buzzing, and it's Twitter. And I'm looking on it and I'm like, what's going on? You know, and I start seeing some of this traffic. And it's coming from all over, you know. Started in New York for whatever reason. That's kind of where somebody had retweeted it there, and it started gaining steam. And I walked into my office, and my secretary said, "Hey, NPR would like to talk to you." And I assumed it was a local NPR station. And I said, "That's fine. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk to you."
That was Kelly McEvers.
And she said, it's All Things Considered. Yeah. And I said, wait, what? She said, yeah, it's All Things Considered. And then a friend of mine came in and said, Dan Rather just tweeted about you, you know. And I couldn't really comprehend what was happening. And for the next, you know, week, really, it was unreal. I just very, very humbling. I still don't get it, but I was grateful for it.
But do you think that there was an impression that here was a man who had – because you said – in fact, let me play this. I want to play this moment from the speech.
Sure.
Because you say in this that your heart changed. But I want people to get a sense of what you said. So let's play. This is a fairly long clip, but I want people to get a sense of what you said last June. Here's Spencer Cox.
I grew up in a small town. I went to a small rural high school. There were some kids in my class that were different than me, and sometimes I wasn't kind to them. I didn't know it at the time, but I know now that they were gay. I regret not treating them with the kindness, dignity, and respect, the love that they deserved. For that, I sincerely and humbly apologize. Over the intervening years, my heart has changed. It has changed because of you. It has changed because I've gotten to know many of you. You have been very patient with me as I went through this change. You even helped me learn the right letters in the alphabet in the right order, even though you keep adding new ones. You have been kind to me. Jim DeBacchus even told me I dress nice once, and I know he's lying. You have treated me with the kindness, dignity, respect, the love that I very often did not deserve. And it has made me love you.
What do you mean your heart changed? Because I think the perception was, and maybe this is wrong, but my sense of the reason it took off is because people thought, hey, here's a conservative Mormon guy who's rethinking his ideas about gay people. But that seems only partly true. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well,
what do you mean your heart changed?
So my, and I say, you know, over the intervening years, I think there were some people that thought that my heart changed because of the Orlando shooting, and clearly, I think, hopefully that impacted all of us, but it was a change that had happened long ago and long before that. And it was really when I apologize now, I wasn't a bully. And you know, I didn't beat anybody up or do anything like that, but we would make fun of people behind their back, you know, as high school kids often do. And I don't know that that's changed too much. And I didn't know that some of these people were gay, didn't find out until many years later. I've had contact with some of them since then. I've with some of them since the speech, actually. And it wasn't until I started getting to know people from the LGBT community, spending time with them. There was a particular reporter that I got to know very early on in my political career, and just came to respect and deeply admire and love this person. And it just changed my whole outlook on how we should treat people, on the way we should interact with people, and with such a positive impact on me. And I just wanted to apologize, because the interesting thing to me coming out of this speech was how many people. I kept waiting for some backlash, right? I thought, because it's
backlash
almost
from where?
From the
conservative,
you know, conservative,
sure.
Far right, religious right, maybe, yep. The usual suspects, and it never came, and it never came, and it never came, and I'm talking thousands and thousands and thousands of letters, messages, posts, you know, emails, and one or two that were negative, and people just kept coming up to me and saying, "Thank you for saying exactly what I was thinking," and that it was kind of mind blowing that so many people, and people I didn't expect to hear it from, were saying, "I feel the same way. You know, I've changed too, and maybe we don't believe the same things, but I'm starting to love these people, and not, I don't want to be mean to these people, and I want to be closer to these people, and we can do better, and I'm sad about this shooting, and it hurts me, and I don't know how to express that, and you gave voice to what I was thinking, and to me, I think that was the best part, coming, especially in an election cycle where up is down, and things are crazy, and there's so much hate and rhetoric and demagoguery out there in our nation today. We talk about the silent majority all the time that I kind of stopped thinking it existed. But then I heard from it, and I heard from it loudly, and I heard from it from across the world, and from conservatives and liberals and religious and atheists and everybody saying the same thing. You know, this matters, and it gives me hope for the future, as dark as it may seem at times.
Can I just push back a little bit
please,
on this? Because
please.
I think this is interesting. There's a writer and gay rights activist named C.J. Prince, who was one who wrote kind of a response in part to your speech. And she said essentially what she was saying is, Spencer Cox, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that you feel solidarity with gay people and then not advocate for full equality. Here's what she wrote. She said, "Dear weeping politicians, it is long past time for you to connect these dots. You cannot in one moment marginalize, demonize, and cast as other a particular group, then in the next moment lament the fact that that group is being targeted for a hate crime." Which gets to the bigger question of, you are a religious person. You were once an LDS bishop. And I don't want to get too crass about it, but does it mean in some ways that you now believe, as I imagine you didn't before, that gay people who choose to commit to a partner or get married or even consummate that relationship, you know, sexually, are not immoral? You know what I mean? I mean, that seems to be where the rubber meets the road for a lot of people. So how are you thinking about that?
Yeah.
Does that
yeah.
make sense?
It does. It does make sense, and it's important, and I understand that. There's a couple responses that I would give back, and one is that when we look at this issue in particular, we recognize that it takes hearts and minds a long time to change. And this is one area where hearts and minds have actually, I think, changed more rapidly than maybe at other times. Yeah. I think there are some great things happening on the equality front. I look at what we did just a year and a half ago here in the state of Utah, a day I never thought I would see, where members of the LGBT community leadership and members of apostles of the LDS Church are in a room together negotiating and working on common ground and standing together to celebrate the signing of a bill that shouldn't have happened and hasn't happened in many states, but somehow was able to happen here in the state of Utah. I don't think that's nothing. I think that's significant, and I think that's a big thing. As far as the
religion, the church has lately called gay people apostates, won't baptize their children until they become adults. I mean, is that a step backward?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you perceive that as an active, devoted, former leader of the LDS Church?
I know it's hard for a lot of members of the church, and something people have had to learn to deal with. But I believe, and obviously she would disagree with me, that you can have a distinction between believing that something is immoral and still loving that person as you love someone who is exactly like you. I don't believe we have to have those dividing lines. Look, I don't drink coffee, right? And I don't hate someone else because they do drink coffee, you know. And I'm not here to rank sins. That's not my job. I'm as screwed up as the next person, and we all are. And that's what came out of this is, you know, look, we're all screwed up. We all have our problems. Whatever the church teaches about that, that's fine. But that does not influence the way I interact with you, or the way I care about you, or the way I treat you. And until we get there, we've got a long ways to go.
Spencer Cox is with us. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Spencer Cox is with us today, the Lieutenant Governor of the state. We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you about your wife, because as I said, she seems pretty amazing. And there's this story that some people may know. I hadn't really heard about it. Your sister, Emily, has cystic fibrosis.
Yeah.
She was able to give birth once, but it was a fairly dangerous pregnancy. And so your wife, Abby, steps in to, I don't know if it's surrogate is the right term, but to be this gestational carrier. She basically carries the baby for your sister and brother-in-law. And I want to ask you about that because it sounds like she's even more, even more remarkable than you are.
It's not even close.
It's not even close. But I think that it's interesting. I wanted you to ask you about this conversation you have about it because it started with this article in the Salt Lake Tribune, you see.
Yeah.
And you know, Emily, your sister's dealing with this. And you send it to Emily, but also to Abby. What's the conversation like between you and your wife as you're thinking about this really amazing thing?
Well, it was, wow, yeah. So this article comes out. The reason I send it to Emily and to my wife is we know this person. We have a common friend, and I just thought it was fascinating. It was about cystic fibrosis, and it was really interesting.
Oh,
and
it wasn't you saying, "Here's an idea."
No, not at all. Okay. No, it was just a, "Hey, we know her. This is really a cool story," you know? And that was the end of the conversation. Just out of nowhere, my wife says to me, she just said, "You know, I think I could do that for Emily." And I just said, "Are you crazy?" And she said, "No." And if you know my wife too, this is not her personality. This was, you know, just, she's an incredible human being, but this isn't something that you would expect to.
She doesn't just go off on a whim.
No, not at all, not at all. And so she's, and we're very close with my sister, and they're out walking one day as they walked, you know, almost every day, and they just started talking about it, and she just said, "You know, I've been thinking about this," and you know, my sister just, you know, kind of starts crying, and she's had people offer to do this for her, and she's always said no, there's no way. She and her husband had been having this conversation, and he said, "You know, would you ever let someone do that for you?" And she said "Abby's the only person that I think I would ever, you know, even trust to do something like that." And so there was just, again, this incredible, miraculous moment, meeting of the minds that we believe was inspired. And that started a really amazing journey for both of our families over the next year, really. And
now there's little baby Lawson.
Yeah, Lawson just went to kindergarten yesterday, on
not a
Friday
baby anymore,
for the first time. Yeah, it's really, really amazing. Something we haven't talked much about, but we're so grateful for the inspiration of this other couple and what they were able to do, and the surrogate gestational carrier thing is a little confusing at times, but he is 100% the child of my sister and her husband. They're both fertile, and so they went through the process and just had the fertilized egg implanted into Abby. And she was the oven for what was supposed to be 9 months ended up not being 9 months. He was born a little early,
right?
And a little scary times, but again, a miraculous pregnancy, and everything's good. Life is good.
You were quoted by the local paper as saying, "I think we challenged the conservative notions of what it means to be a family." It just seems like another one of these things where you're encountering these sort of orthodox things, and you're not running counter to them, but you're embracing something that's different. Does that seem fair?
I think it's fair. I think it's something that fits within there. Fascinating recent podcast by Malcolm Gladwell about generous orthodoxy.
Yep.
and what that means. And these were things, again, we went through all the hoops. We went to our bishop and our stake president, and they went to the general authorities of the church, and we got the okay from that. And so all of these things fit within the broader context of what I believe is true Christianity, and that is loving others and sacrificing for others. I mean, all this other stuff doesn't matter if you're not doing that. And this was a chance for my wife and my sister who are two of the, just the greatest women on this planet, to sacrifice and do something bigger than themselves. And now we have this incredible human being here because of it.
This is a terrible way to end it, but you don't agree with your boss on Donald Trump.
That is a terrible way to end it.
Isn't it? I'm so sorry, but I just had to ask. I mean, you've said that if you thought the tone from the Trump campaign was changing, you'd be willing to reconsider. You're not going to vote for him now. At least that's what you've said. Are you hearing anything at all that's shifting? Or are you still like, nope?
Not much.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it seems like it's always one step forward and two back. And I'll push back just a little. The governor and I are really not on different pages on this. The only difference is who we're voting for. How we feel about it is virtually identical. And I'm not critical of him at all. He's not critical of me. We both know we're
You're
just
not crazy for the nominee.
We're just in a terrible position, and you have to do something. And he's decided to do that. I've decided not to, at least right now. There's still, 77 days? I don't know how long until the election. We have an election to run, and that's where our focus is going to be. That's going to turn out however it turns out. But it's put, I think, every Republican and conservative in a very, very difficult situation, a very difficult decision.
Spencer Cox, Lieutenant Governor for the state of Utah. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. It's been nice getting to know you better.
Thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.